Hello, hello, hello. This is Dom, the editor with the University of Illinois Press, and we're here talking with Marley Bunch on her new book, Unlearning the Hush: Oral Histories of Black Female Educators in Mississippi in the Civil Rights Era. So, how you doing today, Marley?
Good morning, Dom. So good to be in conversation with you.
Yes. So, as I told you right before we got ready to record, I'd love to, for those who do have the book or are hoping to pick it up, each section, each chapter of the book starts out with this poetic benediction. And so, I wanted to honor that tradition of the book by opening up our talk today with a benediction read by Marley herself. So, I'm not putting her on the spot. We have already planned this. And so, I am looking forward to what you are going to be blessing the people with.
Lucille Clifton's The Lost Women. There's a small story that goes with it. This postcard, my good friend Emily Pettit, whose poems are also in the book, sent me this postcard as I was in the throes of writing this book, and it really has just stayed with me. I think it represents the book well. So, Lucille Clifton's The Lost Women. I need to know their names. Those women I would have walked with jauntily, the way men go in groups, swinging their arms. And the ones, those sweating women, whom I would have joined after a hard game to chew the fat. What would we have called each other, laughing, joking into our beer? Where are my gangs, my teams, my mislaid sisters? All the women who could have known me, where in the world are their names?
Love that. Beautiful, beautiful. Unlearning the Hush. And so through oral history, Marley chronicles the lives and voices of Black female educators who taught before and after Brown versus Board in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. By amplifying these women's stories, she does the critical work of reclaiming their names and correcting the imbalance of the weight of history, a practice Bunch refers throughout as undoing or unlearning the hush. And so, how I wanted to start is, Marley, I know that your work is heavily informed by your relationships with both your mother and your grandmother. How did witnessing their lives and careers influence your work, both out in the world and the work that you do in this book here?
Oh, that's a good question. So my mother was born and raised in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. My grandmother, taught for nearly 40 years in Hattiesburg, but she passed before I was able to really know her and learn her story. My other grandmother was really formative in my life and raising me. And so I've always had an affinity for being around my elders. The idea of listening to stories, I think, was such an integral part of how I was raised and how I came to kind of regard memory and community. And so when I was actually having a conversation with my mom and she was talking about her sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Jimmy Heath, who mentored her for, oh my gosh, 60 plus years. And I said, has anyone ever captured Mrs. Heath's story? And my mother said, no. Why would anyone want the story of a Black teacher from Hattiesburg? And so for me, that was that moment, right? That was that lost women moment of like, well, I want it. And I want my children to have those stories and future teachers. And so I think what I learned from my grandmother and my mom was the importance of preserving histories and stories, even those that maybe aren't seemingly important to others, right? The idea of like safeguarding our histories and our stories, I think was always instilled in me. So this is just a kind of full circle moment to honor them through this work.
I love that. I love that. And I think it's interesting because you talk in the book about what's referred to as the big event, right, of Brown versus Board of Education and the idea how you're drawing on the phenomenon. How do you believe that your research, adds to, or more importantly, takes away from the on the ground and collective efforts of educators in your text?
Yeah, I think initially when I started the research, I incorrectly assumed that many of the stories would revolve around Brown v. Board and desegregation. And as I began my conversations, one of my participants said, You've got to shift how you keep referring to Brown v. Board, because remember, Brown v. Board didn't happen. Desegregation didn't happen until 16 years after 1954 in Mississippi, right? And so
You're
they'd be
right.
like, you have to stop saying Brown v. Board. And what I realized, I think, in that conversation specifically, was it really wasn't about desegregation. What came to the surface was the incredible things that educators and their students in the community were able to do in spite of all of these things, right? Jim
Right.
Crow, segregated schools. There really was this interior aspects to their lives in the community that I don't know has been celebrated and illuminated. And so I had to think through, like, is it academic, quote, enough, right, to celebrate this history, and that it is celebratory, even in the midst of all of this. That's what I think I learned the most from my participants, was the joy that existed in Black spaces, the way in which community worked together to uplift one another. And that was a story that I had never heard, definitely not in my textbooks in school. And so I wanted to add to this history by preserving best what I felt like their voices shared with me. And that was that reality of, yes, we were in the midst of all of these harsh realities, but within that, we had joy and we celebrated and we had incredible things happen to our students and with one another. And that's what I wanted to help bring to the forefront.
And I love that you talk about how this really is a celebration and that they see their lives, I think, in the process of doing the oral history of worth celebrating, because that definitely stuck out of your mother being like, why would anybody want stories about these folk? Right. And in saying, well, because they deserve to be celebrated as well. And a Black history is not just about these major events. And I think that's oftentimes what comes out of like civil rights studies and folks who do it. And what part of what the redress in this era is that it's not just about these major figures, right? It's not just about these, again, flag point and flagship moments, but really, how are everyday people living and loving and enjoying life in the midst of all of this? And so I really enjoyed, and I think that that really shines through in how you constructed the book. So again, for those who haven't picked it up yet, it has these beautiful poems, original pieces, original poetry pieces by other scholars and also just poets themselves. And it's also some, there's quite a bit of visual art that I'm not sure, was this commissioned with Kevin, the artist, or were these pieces of his that you found and found inspiration? And how did that collaboration come to be?
Yeah, let's celebrate and raise Kevin. So Kevin Hopkins, at the time was a local artist in Kansas City. He's currently in Virginia, working on his master's, but he's phenomenal. And I was lucky enough to meet Kevin, and I just said, "Hey, will you, like, can we collaborate? Will you help me make these stories literally visual and create artwork?" And he was like, "Yeah, let's do it." And so we actually reached out to some galleries in Kansas City, and Haw Contemporary Gallery did a show. We did a show for, I think it ran for 10 weeks, called Unlearning the Hush. And so all of the pieces that you see in the book of Kevin's, there are other artists, but the ones that you see of Kevin's are all original pieces he created for this research and this work.
I love that. I love to hear that. Big ups to Kevin. Got to meet him very briefly a little while ago. So yeah, just like I said, I think that it is interesting in how I say that the book is an archive unto itself, is kind of how I've always spoken about it, both internally and when I do talk to it with folks out in the world. It's not just about chronicling, but again, creating something. And something that's really lovely that I go back to again and again when we look at the piece is these personal letters that you include from some of the people that you interviewed for the oral histories. What was one of your favorite pieces of advice or little bit that you learned from the letter that really illuminated either something from the interview or if you could go back, what you would do with that?
That's a great question. I love letters. I think that there's something so special about handwritten letters. And so It was about not only preserving what could be found of things like annuals, which were yearbooks from Black schools, but it was also about, as you mentioned, in real time, how can we create something for future readers and generations? And so Mrs. Ellie Damer, she's the wife of civil rights activist Vernon Damer, who did so much for voting rights in Mississippi. And she just turned 100 years old. And she, the letter that she wrote gives me chills, but she talks about the work that she put forward, others put forward, her husband did as well to preserve voting rights and things like that. And so she urges readers to vote, to get a library card, to know your history. Just simple everyday advice, but things that sometimes we forget, you know, as we're busy and doing life. So that letter was really special. And then there is a letter by Dr. Joyce Ladner. She's another incredible civil rights activist. And in that, she gives like advice. It's numbered advice, and it's really stunning as well. And is paired in the same chapter with the letters that she received from Medgar Evers, who was one of her mentors. So it's such a beautiful, I think, legacy and passing down of this written gift, really, of advice and guidance.
Yeah.
So.
And I think it really helps highlight what, again, these big events miss about what's lost in the desire to advance for all of the things that the civil rights is interested in advancing. And I think something that stuck out to me, I can't remember if it was one of the letters or if it was one of the interviews. I do remember it was Mrs. Julia Brown, and when she confronts the emotional trauma of all of the disenfranchisement that happens from desegregation, right? And I remember reading through folks' timelines and being like, that's wild that they're having them go to a new school their last year of high school or their last semester. Like at that point, let's just finish out what we've got here. And she speaks to this idea that, you know, lots of Black children lost their rankings in school. And all of the trauma, again, she talks about, I believe it's her letter again, talks about having to go to school after Martin Luther King Jr. is assassinated and the vitriol and the humor with which all of that is met by her classmates and overall everything that comes with not being accepted in that environment. And so I wanted to know, how might we reframe these unintended consequences of these efforts to think about closing achievement gaps today in the classroom? How do we not kind of propagate or continue that legacy?
That's such a great question. That's a hard question. So many of the things that happened then, we see still the ripple effects today. So that, as an educator, that was so great for me to kind of gather their wisdom and try to think about how can we apply this to 21st century classrooms, and figure out how to navigate the times that we're in now. I would say representation matters, right? And that, listening to their stories, it was so evident that being in spaces, feeling affirmed by Black educators, Charles Cooper, who is one of my participants, he not only became an educator, but he was the student of many of the educators in the book, right? So I also interviewed students of who were taught by the women I interviewed. But he said, if you can see it, you can be it.
Yeah.
And I never, like, right, again, another such simple thing, but it's so true. And he said, you know, his greatest mentors were his teachers. And so even though he knew what the greater world might think of him, that within the space of his school, he said, I could be valedictorian. I could be the prom king. You know, I was uplifted. I was encouraged by my teachers, and I really felt like I could do and be anything. And so I
Yeah.
think when we think about what can we learn today? I would say that's one of them, right? The importance of having Black and Brown teachers in classrooms again, we know matters. And I also would say teaching accurate and inclusive history. We know that matters deeply as well. And many of my participants talked about, learning Margaret Walker's For My People and learning about Black history in their schools. And so those are things that were afforded during that time that I think created that sense of I can do and be anything. And so bringing those back into classrooms today and or ensuring they remain, I think is critical.
Yeah, and I think that dovetails really well with one of the last questions that I kind of have here before we move into just more conversation. But I know that toward the end of Unlearning the Hush, I believe it's Vanessa Sadell Walker states that the culture of Black teaching died with Brown. And I think that that's what you're speaking to right there, right? Is that there's so much that Black students and Black children are missing out on when the idea of their history and their culture is not brought into the classroom. And so as an educator yourself, how have you brought that, again, that culture of Black history and Black teaching into the classroom? And what do you recommend for folks who are currently working in the field and want to be able to do that, whether they're Black teachers themselves or otherwise?
You're just coming with all the hard questions. I think I have always leaned on storytelling in classrooms. I've been lucky because the majority of my teaching by choice has been in schools that are predominantly Black and Brown schools, those which have been titled, Title I or high risk or whatever name has been given to them. Those are the schools that I wanted to be, the spaces that I wanted to be. And so I've been lucky in that oftentimes in those schools, I think you have more freedom with things like curriculum and text choices. And so I was able to bring in Black history and use stories as a vehicle to show kind of perspective taking to students and what does that look like. So I would say for schools, we know that there's obviously a struggle now, right? How do we rectify reality with curriculum that we're teaching students. And again, I would just say making sure that we are being culturally responsive and we're walking in the path of these greats like Vanessa Siddle Walker, Gloria Ladson Billings. Black teachers are not an anomaly in the fact of like the amazing things that we are able to do. And what I love about these stories is I think as you read through them, you realize this was everyday teaching and living. And the educators in the book went to great lengths. I mean, that part just really struck me to the lengths to which educators went to continue their own learning and professional development, right? They couldn't attend most of the universities that were right there where they lived. And so often, my mother talks about this. My grandmother would travel in the summer to go, take courses and get her master's. I would say 90% of the women I interviewed had their master's degree. And
Yeah.
think about that, achieving that during Jim Crow segregated times, like it's
It's unimaginable.
Unimaginable. And so, I mean, it just made me so proud. And so I would say one of the things we can do as educators and community members is continue our own learning. That I think was such a critical piece that I heard from all of the women that I interviewed, that dedication to consistently learning, was always present. And they were willing to do it in the face of violence, death, barriers of all kinds. And so I think about that when I think about how can I make my students better? And that is by always pushing my own learning, and my personal growth in that area.
What are you learning right now?
Oh, wow. I am working on a new project called A Litany for Survival. And so I have been interviewing Black educators, women and men. And what I wanted to see is do these themes that we see in Mississippi, if I interview someone from Gary, Indiana, or Illinois, are these themes similar? And so I'm learning about intergenerational themes and legacies. I think that happen in Black communities and Black education. And that has been like just a continuation of this work. It's been really, really eye-opening. And I'm always, again, I'm so proud to walk in this legacy. And I think we all exist through legacy. So for me, this is just such a proud moment to be able to continue my learning through the voices and perspectives of these incredible people who I have such admiration for.
As we talk about that, because I see the work itself, right? I see Unlearning the Hush as an intergenerational project unto itself. You know, it transcends age and in a ton of ways, I think illuminates something about Black folk in education. Again, the book, it has these historical vignettes that have been written by Professor Christopher Spann. It has these original art pieces. It also has art pieces from other artists in addition to Kevin. It's got these poems, right? The oral histories. It's got the personal letters as well, both archival ones and new ones that you commissioned from your interviewees themselves. And so I like to say it really resists chronology. And I know that we talked about kind of the puzzle of how to put it all together a few times, right? We put it together a few different ways before we really landed on what I believe to be really the best construction of the book, where you really can, I would almost say, you can open that book up anywhere and kind of really dig in, and you don't need a bunch of runway to understand what's going on. And I've picked it up a few times and I've started with something different, whether it's, you know, starting with the history or the letter. And I feel different when I come back to it from that space, or maybe just, you know, hitting on a poem. And so you mentioned the intended flexibility of the volume. And again, there's many ways to dive into the book, and you're not necessarily meant to read it cover to cover. And so how do you like to enter the book when you go back to it now? And for a first-time reader, what would you recommend? If you say no cover to cover, where would you recommend someone start?
Oh, wow. That's, I think, I mean, we built it to your point intentionally, right? So it is almost like a quilt. We know the important role of quilting, in the Black community. My grandmother quilted. And so I think you could start anywhere. I would say start with the historical vignettes by Dr. Christopher Spann, who is an incredible historian. And his vignettes, I think, really help frame the historical aspects of what is occurring throughout the book. And also, you can read them standalone. So I would say start with those. They close each chapter. I think the other interesting way to read it is just visually. There's full color artwork, which is, I mean, it's stunning. And so I think reading it as you're just looking at the artwork, and then you get to see the black and white images of the participants. And so those are the two ways that I would recommend starting, especially if it's not a history that, you know, because I thought about that. If you're not a teacher, if you are not black, what is your entrance to this book? And so I think that the art and the historical vignettes is a great way to start, and then going in and maybe reading it cover to cover. The oral histories, you could also just read the oral histories. Yeah, there's so many ways. And I think that is the educator in me realizing we all acquire information differently. We all absorb information and interact with information differently. And so when I think about histories other than my own that I have wanted to learn about, I've wanted to feel like I was welcome to enter them at different learning points throughout my progression of learning about that community or culture. And so I wanted to do that for Unlearning the Hush as well. So I hope, I think we've achieved it. I hope so.
I think you've achieved it. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know what else are you? I know you got the Litany of Survival that you are working on as we speak, but you do have another book that came out recently. You want to speak about that for a second?
Yeah, so I got to co-author a book called Leveraging AI for Human-Centered Learning. And that book was really born out of a discussion with my dear friend and colleague, Brittany Collins, who's also an educator. And we were kind of just bemoaning one night, like, what are we going to do with AI, right? What do teachers do With AI? And the answer is definitely not. We're just going to ban it because the reality is it's our students are using it. We are using it. It's on our phones. Like it's here. So what are we going to do? And so we really started to explore some of the different AI tools together with the intention of we know the heart, and unlearning the hush proves that the heart of classrooms is always going to be teachers and students, right? The relationships that are built, those moments that happen when you close the door and a student figures something out, or you learn from your students. There's so many moments that AI will never, in my opinion, be able to reproduce. So we wanted to kind of write a guide to how can you keep learning human-centered and pair some of the good AI tools with it so that it's not, I don't know that they can be separate forever. And if we think about all the things that as students and teachers we've gone through, the overhead projectors, the smart boards, I feel like as teachers, we have to kind of work through innovation and be willing to kind of walk alongside our students and introduce them to it. And also talk about the perils, right? We know there are many perils to AI. And so it's really a kind of a guide to helping teachers wrap their brains around how do I bring this into my classroom in an ethical way and still keep my teaching human-centered. So, yeah.
I love that. I love that. And I think that, again, even going back to unlearning the hush, is what we come to find out that education is about community. And until we wrestle with the conundrum of how do we rethink what community looks like in the
Yeah.
world today, I know so little about AI that I will stop right there because I will betray my own ignorance if I state any more. So I won't say anything else. What I'd love to know is there anything that you want to speak on? Like, is there a question that you wish that I had asked you today or that you thought of while we were talking?
Maybe the question of what myths do I hope that this book helps to dispel? And so I think there are two myths that I hope that it helps to dismantle. The first is what I mentioned earlier, right? That there are these anomalies in Black history and Black education of like Vanessa Siddle Walker is masterful at being able to illustrate that this really is part of our teaching legacy. We are not anomalies, but I hope that this book helps to further illustrate that. And then I think the second thing would be scholarship can look different than what we are typically and traditionally used to it looking, right?
Yes.
And you and I had many conversations about that because, I mean, this is like, if I had to say which book had my heart, it is most certainly this book. And when you are putting people's stories out into the world, who you have con I mean, so I am regularly in contact with so many of these participants and hold them
Yeah.
in high regard that it was so important to me, like how I don't want to put a book out and not have it well received. And so I remember so many times you work it like Marley, it's okay.
Yeah.
We're okay. But it's important, I think, that you want your work to be well received and understood. But I think what you did such a great job at reminding me of is that scholarship can look different. It doesn't have to be, it doesn't always have to be the way it's been. And so
Yeah.
this book helped me step into that.
Yeah, and I mean, and I think that that's in the tradition of, doing work in the academy as a Black woman. I think that that's what Black women have always offered, to the academy, is that there's another way to do this besides what we are doing, and that we learn something. And there is a lot of pushback that comes to putting scholarship out like that. Like, what is this? It's and the idea of rigor, as if that is always the bar that we're supposed to be trying to clear, assuming that the idea that something has to be rigorous to have merit in the
Yeah.
world. And not to say that anything should be out and be called scholarship. I'm not saying that, right? when we do something some way for so long, we put a certain level of inflexibility that's just not good for living, breathing, like scholarship. And I, like I said, I think this work does that in a very profound way. This is something that anybody could pick up because I don't have much experience in Black education outside of what I get to hear from my amazing authors that I work with. But it was interesting. It was interesting to read through, and it wasn't cumbersome.
And that's the goal. I think for me, the marker was, can my participants read this and feel like I told their story in a way that honored the realities of it? And so that, a few of them have since received the book, and I feel proud. I think that I have done that. I think Secretary Lonnie Bunch, there's one of the chapters I start with his quote, and he says, that's what memory does. It allows a living community to shape its past in profound ways. And I think that's such a beautiful way to sum up this book, right? It was to show the wholeness, the full breadth of participant stories and their lives and really their contributions, and their contributions should most certainly be celebrated because so many of the things that they were able to accomplish. And you mentioned it earlier, everyday people doing great things. And we think about Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and all of the different groups that organize through churches and community. And I mean, just again, I'm just so proud to walk in that legacy. And I understand that because of their contributions, we are all better and able to do more. And so it's a nice beacon of hope as we figure out how to navigate today.
I love that. I love that. I think that gets it done. That wraps it up there. We're gonna stop right there because that was a word. So again, Marley, thank you for trusting Illinois, trusting me with this work and with their work. That's something that we try to do as humbly as possible, and it is important to think of it like that, and that we're in community now, just in putting it all together. So I said thank you for the opportunity. This is Marley Bunch. Her book is Unlearning the Hush: Oral Histories of Black Female Educators in Mississippi in the Civil Rights Era. If you are hearing my voice, that means it is out. So you can go on our website at Illinois Press to pick it up, or you can also get it on Amazon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.